Good morning. I have 9 o'clock, so let's get started. So apologies for the grandiose title, but it worked wonders with the program committee, apparently. So this talk came about, I gave a talk, let me turn this on. I gave a talk at work maybe a couple of years ago now, and it was very much inspired by Sean Parent's seasoning talks. And I had a slide in that talk that said, my claim is that this is the most powerful algorithm in the world. And at the time I said, but that's another talk. So this is the result of that, this is that talk. So did accumulate. I want to talk about accumulatable things and start off fairly slowly, gently. So here's accumulate. We all know it and love it perhaps. One thing to notice here is that it looks like there's a lot of kind of value semantics going on, and perhaps you might think a lot of copies. But in my experience, I found that compilers are pretty good at optimizing those copies away. I took a look at this with an instrumented class that counted copies and moves, and compared it to a version that of accumulate that used kind of explicit moves, and I found almost no difference. The only difference was in the very first input parameter passed to the function itself. These are typical uses. I'm aware this is not what you're here for. This is kind of like what you think of when you first meet the accumulate. Yes, we can compute, triangle numbers and factorials, and this is very boring. But what else can we do? So something else very simple we can do is compute a maximum value. Again, you're all here at CPCon, so you all know this. I hope everyone's convinced this will find the maximum value. By the way, ask questions if you have any during the talk, and I'll try and answer them, or we'll tell you that I'm about to answer them in another slide. So we could write min element in a value-based sense and do something like this. We could also do things like accumulating Boolean values. And this is very similar to the all of, any of, and none of in the library, except without the nice shortcut behavior. So you might think, why would we do this? It isn't very interesting as it stands. But things become a little more interesting if we look at the signature of the function that gets passed to accumulate. These types, perhaps we used to think of these types as being the same, but they can vary. So let's look at things when they differ. So here's a simple example, a more interesting case, again, accumulating Booleans, but in this case, it's sort of inspired by Herb Sutter's favorite 10 lines of code. We've got some kind of weak pointer cache here. And we've got a function to load. We're asking for a bunch of things we want to load into the cache. Now, because get thing returns a shared pointer, which we can treat like a Boolean, we can accumulate across the things that we pass in. And we don't actually want the shortcut behavior here because we're asking for all of these IDs. Some will be in the cache, some won't. For the ones that won't, we actually do want to service all of them and ask for all of them and get back. What we get back is whether we need to service the requests or not. So here you can imagine make async request actually does some work and kind of presumably pushes a request onto some other queue. And then we know from the result of accumulate whether all the things are cached or not. And we can call service async requests. So note that we don't want a shortcut here, and you'll note the order of arguments to and here. So the cached argument comes second, and we're always calling get thing. So this kind of pattern can be useful, just because we use many function results as if they were Boolean values in control flow. Sometimes it's actual Booleans, oftentimes it's pointers, could be zero results of comparison trichotomies like Strcomp. We write Boolean operators for our Boolean conversion operators for our classes a lot anytime we want to write if x. And that means we can use accumulate to collect those kind of function values. And again, it's similar to the standard library, the new algorithms, but where we don't want the short-circuiting behavior. Okay, so we can accumulate Boolean values. There's a bunch more things we can accumulate. And all of these things have something in common. So joining strings, we can accumulate into one big string. This is very similar to building requests from key value pairs. If you think about an HTTP request, the headers or the arguments. Merging JSON objects. You can imagine that we could accumulate a bunch of JSON objects into one big JSON object. Multiplying matrices is also something we can accumulate. So the question is, what do all these have in common? And what they have in common is that they're all monoids, which you probably remember, because it's been talked about a lot in conferences. So basically, a monoid is a set of objects and an operation such that the operation is closed over the set, it's associative, and there's an identity element. And this is exactly kind of what we need. In fact, a little bit stronger than what we need in some cases to accumulate things. So here's an example. I was talking about HTTP headers. Here's an example of rewriting something in terms of accumulate. So we've got headers here as a map of key value pairs. And this is curl. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a C style interface. And we're just building up a list of headers by appending a string onto our header list. So this is a raw loop, and we could rewrite it in accumulate style. Here, we're just going through the headers again and appending to the list, and we're accumulating the list of headers. And the result here is that it's one expression. There's no declaration initialization split. If you look here, we declare curl headers and then we mutate it. Here we just declare it and initialize it in one line. So this allows us, if we like, to use almost always auto style. So once you start looking for monoids, they turn out to be everywhere, and any monoid can be accumulated. So some examples, just a few examples: addition on integers, concatenating strings, union sets, merging objects of all kinds. What we've seen in the Boolean cases, parsing is a monoid, applying AI behaviors could be a monoid, composing images, set into sections, optional is a monoid. And once you realize that what you're dealing with is a monoid, i.e. that you can compose, you have a binary operation, and then you can run accumulate, it can simplify your APIs. This happened when I was at work, and I was looking at a friend's code, and he was wondering he wasn't even working in C++, he was working in JavaScript. And he had a list of objects, and he wanted to kind of merge them all into one object, accumulate all of the effectively key value pairs in the JavaScript object. But all he had was a binary function to merge two. And I looked at it with him, and then I suddenly realized, all you need to do, the binary function is all you need, because you just reduce in JavaScript across the collection of objects, and that is exactly accumulate. So a type can be a monoid in more than one way, and the obvious example of this is integers. They can be a monoid under addition. They can also be a monoid under multiplication. And the identity for addition is 0, and the identity for multiplication is 1, as I'm sure you know. Also, any function that returns a monoid, we saw the functions returning shared putter, which we treated as Boolean. Any function that returns a monoid can itself be treated as a monoid, because you can just aggregate the output of the function. And saying the same thing in a different way, map. So if the value in a map is a forms a monoid, then the map itself is a monoid. Because you can imagine, so that's really the same thing as the function claim, because if we think of functions as regular functions that don't depend on any external input, then you could implement, in theory, you could implement any function as just a map from inputs to outputs. All right, enough of the abstract algebra. So why would we do this, and why wouldn't we just write a loop? Well, one thing I've mentioned is that when we do this, we don't have a declaration initialization split, which is good. It's often easier to write the binary function than to think about summing a collection of things. I'm going to say summing for aggregating. It simplifies an API. If you're writing an API and you can identify that a type you're providing to your users forms a monoid, then all you have to do is provide them with that merging function, that binary function, and they get accumulate for free effectively. And you also get incremental computation because you can accumulate by parts, as it were. You can take the result of accumulate and keep on accumulating things into it. Of course, also we get the potential for parallel computation if we can use something like the parallel counterpart of accumulate, perhaps in modern C++ will be reduce and its friends. And if our types are right, then we don't have to just accumulate things linearly. We could, but since the monoid operation is associative, it means you can accumulate a bunch of things over here, a bunch of things over here, and when you accumulate the results, you get the right answer. Okay, so this is sort of what accumulate does. It turns binary functions into n-ary functions because it allows you to operate over collections with binary functions. It collects, as we've seen, the results of functions whose outputs are monoidal. And in some sense, because it offers us this incremental ability, it allows us to treat part-whole hierarchies uniformly. So you can keep on folding things in. And that also allows us to do parallel computation. So a little aside about parallel computation and monoids. You can see here, basically, why parallelism works on a monoid. You've got identity. This is the identity. Doesn't matter if we have anything here because we've got an identity which is zero. This is just adding up numbers. And you can see that we get the right thing because the operation is associative. Here is another example of computing a mean. And this just involves keeping track of the pair of things, the count of numbers and the sum. And we keep track of those separately. And again, we get the right answer because the operation is associative and we have an identity. And so reduce, which is new in C++ 17, is really the same as accumulate, except that the sequence can be processed in any order, perhaps according to policy. And it works because of associativity. But what you get is you gain the parallelism, but you lose the type variation because to have parallelism, I think you need, it basically assumes that you're doing a generalized sum of things of the same type. But if you're actually using things of different types, then there's probably a linear computation required to keep folding things in. If you work in big data, then monoids really are everywhere. Some examples of that, you've got regular and decayed averages, top-end calculations, histograms. A histogram is just a bucket of, a bunch of buckets of values. You can imagine how to combine two histograms. You simply add the buckets together, bucket-wise. A bunch of probabilistic data structures are also monoids. Things like Bloom filters, distributions. Hyperloglog is a data structure which allows you to count uniques probabilistically. And again, this is just a screenshot from a good site which allows you to play with hyperloglog a bit. The basic of hyperloglog is that you're keeping a register file here, and each one of the values in this register file is computed with a max operation according to the observable bit field you've seen. And so it's trivial to merge multiple register files. You just do a bucket-wise max, and that itself is monoidal, and so the whole thing becomes accumulatable. But that's beyond the scope of this talk, so you can look it up on your own time. So monoids and semigroups. Semigroups are monoids with the relaxed, you don't need an identity to be a semigroup, you just need associativity. But they're the key to parallelism. And the other key is this ability to combine summary data. So for example, with the distribution stuff, if you've got distributions can be combined. So if you've done expensive training on your data set to form a distribution, let's say you you have programmer salaries in Europe and programmer salaries in the US, and you do training on both of those sets, and you form two different distributions. You don't have to, in order to combine the distributions, you don't have to redo the training on the combined set. You can just combine the distributions because that's what that's what monoids do for you. Anyway, so that was a little aside. Now let's get on to some C++ and look at accumulating other things. So right now, accumulate works on linear sequences. So how could we make it work on multidimensional structures? So one thing we could do, if we had a binary tree or something, is just define a linear traversal on it in the usual way. And this would work if we could do that. The nodes of the tree are still homogeneous. What if the tree was a little more complex, like a, let's say, a JSON object is a familiar example of a tree-based structure that is fairly heterogeneous. So here's accumulate, the signature of accumulate. Now, the insight here is that the initial value t is really dealing with the case when we have an empty sequence. And the binary operation deals with the other case when we have a non-empty sequence. So we really have two things we're dealing with. And this is similar to how vectors and sequences are defined in functional languages. We can think of sequence accumulation as these two cases. So either it's an empty vector or it's a vector consisting of, you know, element plus vector. So this is kind of a recursive definition. And if we think of accumulate in this way, it's the key to accumulating nonlinear data structures. So here's an example of the accumulate that we know, kind of written in that style. So if we think of the initial value, not as a value, but a function to call in the case of an empty vector, and the binary operation is, of course, the other function to call, then accumulate looks something like this. Now, it's recursive. We wouldn't use this. But this is the key to getting to accumulating other things. So here is a simple JSON value written as a variant. And if you're familiar with JSON, I mean, it can just be these six things, bool, number, string, null, or an array of JSON values, or a object, which is a set of key value pairs, where the keys are strings and the values are JSON values. So in order to accumulate this, you know, so in the vector case we had, or in the sequence case we had two functions, one to deal with the empty sequence and one to deal with a sequence with something in it. Because we have six options for the JSON value here, we need six functions. Luckily, these functions are pretty simple. So let's look at just accumulating, rendering a JSON data structure with an accumulation. So we know how to render a bool, a double, a string, and a null. These are all trivial. We know how to render an array. All we do is render square brackets either side, and we iterate the array, and we render each value in the array. I didn't put up the code to join here, but you can imagine what it does. It just joins together the strings with the comma in between. And similarly, for the JSON object, how we render an object is very much the same. We render the braces either side, and we just iterate through the effectively the map, and we render the first in the map is the string, and the second in the map is itself a JSON value, which we make a call to render. Okay, so these six functions, I hope you agree, are all simple to write. And then, in theory, all we would need to do is call our multidimensional accumulate, which I'm just calling fold because it's a shorter word. And we pass it these six functions to deal with the six cases in the JSON value. And we pass it the JSON value, obviously. So there is a way to write this function. I'll go through. This is one way to write it. It involves a little templatory. So we've got, it takes a variant of some size. In this case, a JSON value is a variant. And it takes a bunch of functions, one to deal with each value that's possible in the variant. And we just delegate to this foldat function, which we call with the index that's actually active in the variant. So in this case, remember that we're not providing an initial value here. Effectively, it's implicit in dealing with each of the six cases. Okay, so this fold at is itself a function which ends up, now in my formulation here, I have a recursive template definition coming up. There may be better ways to do it. But basically, we're given six functions, we're given a variant, and we know the active index in that variant. And so my what I basically do here is form the index sequence for those of size six, and step through until I hit the one that's equivalent to the index. So that's what this is doing. So this, my function list, I'm effectively consing down the function list. Here's the head and the tail of the functions. And I'm saying, I'm not forming an index sequence. If someone has a formulation that does form an index sequence, it might probably be faster than the recursive template definition. So this is the variant index, and we're saying if this is equal to our template parameter, then we must be at the right function. And so we just call the function on the and getting the value out of the variant. Otherwise, we recurse and we just go to the next template. The final, you know, the end case is, this actually never gets called, but if we run off the end, it never gets called because of the static assert saying that we must have enough functions to deal with the things in the variant. But if we run off the end, this deals with the recursion. This deals with the termination of the type recursion in particular, because the return value R here is needed, because it is computed from just assuming that these things all return the same type. I just compute it from the result of the first one. Jason. Yes, F and F's are callable objects, yeah.
And they're all things that you're not actually storing anywhere, right?
No, not storing them, yes.
I'm just wondering what the advantage is to doing forward on all of these constructs.
Oh, so yes. Is there an advantage to forwarding rather than const reference?
The callable things do not have a const call operator, you're screwed.
Right. Okay, so yes, I'm using forwarding references here. The comment is that maybe const references could be usable, but then if the thing doesn't have a const operator, a call operator, then that wouldn't work. So
fortunately, the compiler will tell you.
Yes, and it would be a compile error, indeed. So basically, this little bit of code is just saying, at the end of the day, take your variant, take your bunch of functions, and whichever value is active in the variant, call the appropriate function on that value. And then right. So because it's recursive, now presumably the function itself then ends up, remember the recursive definition of like printing the array or printing the JSON, it would then result in recursing and accumulating the variant. So when you look at the signature of this function, it looks a lot like visitation, and it is fairly similar. So, I mean, from that sense, accumulation is perhaps not that far out of our everyday, you know, experience. So this is a generic accumulate for variants, or at least one formulation of it. But if you don't have a variant, if you just have a recursively specified data structure in some way, you can still accumulate that using the same idea. Basically, you have a function for each possible sort of, in functional languages they're called constructors, but each possible thing that you could have in your data type, and you use this kind of visitation pattern to accumulate the thing recursively. Yes, yeah.
And so the visitor maybe spare you some time because the compiler will select the right overview.
Right. So the comment is, yes, you need n functions for your n possible values, and so your recursion here, the way I've formulated it in terms of a recursive template is order n. I'm not claiming that my formulation is the best. I'm just saying here's what's possible with accumulation. So I welcome anyone who has better ideas to make this faster.
Your recursion is great. I've used a similar technique, and on Clang GCC and MSVC, it looks like it just compiles to a switch statement. It's like if.
Okay.
If.
So Vincent has the experience that a similar thing he used actually was well optimized by the compiler to something like a switch statement. Okay, so. Why would we do this? Because it separates the traversal of our data structure from the operation that we need to do on it. And as you could see, writing those rendering functions was trivial, and having the way to just run them over the data structure allows us to separate out what we're doing from the traversal. And so we could do lots of other things. So we saw like rendering the tree as a string. We could compute things like depths or fringes of trees. We could, looking further afield, we could do things like lighting contributions. Maybe if you have a quad tree or an arc tree, something like that, you could do sync graph operations, and the list kind of goes on. These are typical recursive data structures in my line of work. I'm sure you could think of your own. So this technique is useful when you have a kind of a heterogeneous hierarchy that might be difficult to define a linear traversal for. If you have a plain binary tree, you might still want to provide a linear traversal of it, depth first or whatever. But this is a heterogeneous way to do that. So we've seen how to accumulate. Accumulate gives us accumulation over a sequence. That technique gives us accumulation over a heterogeneous hierarchy. Let's look at heterogeneous sequences, aka tuples, if you like. So this is accumulate again. So type 1 and type 2 here to the binary operation might be different. So what this is saying is that we know how to fold values of type 2 into type 1. So what if we just allowed type 2 to be different every time? And the accumulator stays fixed, but we know how to fold all kinds of things into the accumulator. And there's one obvious example of this, which is practically ubiquitous, and it's just outputting to an O stream. Effectively, this is saying we know how to fold tons of things into an O stream. We write these functions every day. And so, if we had something like this, a fold for tuples, then we could expect output like this. So in this case, there's a generic lambda, which just says, we know how to fold a ton of things into an O stream. And there's a tuple, and we call fold, and we pass it the tuple. And then our initial value here is actually C out. And then it just ends up outputting all that stuff to C out. Now, this is possible as well, and one formulation of it is very similar to the variant thing that you already saw. Now, one thing, providing C out here, I had the thought that we could structure this function to take, in some sense, the empty tuple, rather than, what we saw before with variant was we didn't have initial value because we effectively, that was implicit in dealing with every case that the sum type, the variant, could be in. In this case, there's a choice between either providing the initial value, the initial O stream here, or somehow you know, making that function deal with empty tuple, and that would be the case where we provided effectively the initial value. Either way is possible. I think this way for this use case is a little cleaner. And the fold for tuples looks something like this. I'll leave the implementation as an exercise to you guys. It's quite similar to the variant style. It's not too difficult, but actually dealing with streams, you know, because they're non-movable, does take a little trickiness, and that's the reason for the decal type auto that I had to have in there. Okay, so what we've seen so far. So accumulate gives us, you know, one function, and we accumulate over a linear homogeneous structure. If we do the nonlinear or the linear tree traversal just on our homogeneous tree structure, we get something very similar. If we have a accumulate over a variant, then we need to provide n functions to deal with the n values that could be in the variant, but it allows us to accumulate the multidimensional structure and the heterogeneous structure. And then a tuple is itself a linear structure, but it's a heterogeneous structure also. So again, we have effectively n functions, although it might be a function template like the outputting to the OStream. So this is the empire that we've got so far. And all of these could be parallelizable given the appropriate semigroup structure. You can imagine that you could break off parts of, if you had a JSON object, a very large tree or something, you could farm out subtrees and parallelize those operations. And then, you know, given those results, you could accumulate those results back up on a different process. Okay, so naturally the question arises, at least to me, if we have accumulate, what's the opposite of accumulate? So if accumulate is somehow folding up a data structure to produce a value, then the opposite would be unfolding a seed value to produce a data structure. And this is something we don't see much in C++ yet. Parsing? Yeah, but I mean, a lot of these things can be viewed, if you view them through one lens, they look one way, and if you view them through a different lens, they look another way, and which you choose is down to you. So if accumulate looks like this, then I think perhaps unfold, as I'm calling it, looks something like this. So it takes a function, and it takes an output iterator, which we're going to write to, and it takes some kind of seed value, the initial value. And the idea is that we're going to call the function repeatedly with this initial value that reduces over time, and we're going to write the results for the output iterator. So the question is, what should the signature of F be? And how do we know when we're done? Right, so these are two questions that arise. So F is going to be the opposite of the binary operation that we pass to accumulate. So if we kind of just invert that, it means that we return a pair. The result is going to be the thing that we write into the output iterator. And then it's going to return the new value of our seed that we're going to pass to the next invocation of F. And in general, the result to write to the iterator could be a range or a sequence of values. So it's not just necessarily just one value, but it could be, you know, it might not just be a char, for instance, it could be a string to write into the string that we're unfolding to. So there's a few choices over how to define F. Choice one, the other question, which is how do we know when we're done, right? One choice is to say, well, we'll have some sentinel value of the same type as the seed, and when the seed reaches that value, it's returned by F eventually, then we're done. We could also say we have a sentinel value of the other type that the function returns, you know, the second part of the pair, which is fine. But both of these choices involve having a sentinel value inside the type. And from my talk yesterday, I don't really like that. The obvious choice to me in this case is to use an optional because that provides you with a sentinel value which is outside of your type. So if f returns an optional, we can simply terminate when it returns null opt. So this is what unfold might look like. The function, so we're taking the seed value, and we've got a for loop. Initially, we're calling the function with the seed value. O here is an optional, and you know it has a conversion to Boolean when it's a null opt, or I should say that fails when it's a null opt. And we know that we can move the second of the pair that was returned, assuming that f returned something. It was a pair of range to write to our output iterator and new seed value. And so inside the for loop, we're simply moving the range to write it to our output iterator, and the for loop terminates when we return null opt. And you know, each time round, it recalls with the new seed. And finally, of course, we return the iterator, the output iterator, because the law of useful return says that we should do that. Otherwise, the caller wouldn't know where the output iterator was. So here's a very trivial example. This is a function that we might pass to unfold, and this is a function written to turn an Arabic number into a string of the Roman numeral. And you can see that although Roman numerals aren't that great, hence this function has a lot of if statements. But this function, I hope you can see, is fairly trivial to write. You just go down and down and down, and you're reducing the seed each time, and you're just outputting whatever you need to output. And then your calling code just looks like this. You just unfold that function over your seed value, and what you get back is the string. So that's a fun little formulation. Marshall. When I said about unfolding, Marshall said he'd call it parsing. Fold and unfold really are the same if you kind of look at them through different lenses. So accumulate. We're conventionally taking a data structure and we're reducing it to a value, and unfold, we are taking a seed value and expanding it to a data structure. But really, the seed value itself is sort of decreasing each time. So you could say we're taking one data structure and transforming it into another with either of these formulations. And which you choose to use is really a matter of convenience. As I say, structures are themselves values in this view of the world. So between them, accumulation and unfolding allows you to do generalized data structure transformations. Yeah.
When I talked about parsing, I was thinking about you had your fold taking a JSON and producing a string. And so you could, if you had the right set of functions, you could have unfold take a string and produce a JSON data structure.
Yes.
See, that's where I got parsing.
Oh, right. Yes. So parsing, thinking about it, so the comment is, if we think about a JSON, the JSON thing we were talking about, the example I presented was accumulating a JSON value and producing the string. Of course, going the other way is exactly parsing the string to produce the JSON value. So that's the end of the main part of my talk, but I have a postscript which is kind of, so at this point, does anyone have any questions? No? Great, well, all right. So I have a postscript which is kind of how this talk came about, which is titled The Fruits of Algorithmic Perversions. So I woke up one morning, and as you do, I thought to myself, if I was stuck on a desert island, which algorithms would I take with me? What are the building block algorithms in the STL? Now, I've watched Sean Parent's talks, like we all have. And so, partition, he talked highly about partition. Rotate, reverse, these are all building block algorithms in the STL, Maybe there are some others. So I thought, which algorithm is the most powerful? And what if I couldn't write any loops except for just one to implement the one algorithm? And I was stuck with that. And which one would I pick? And so that was what led me to try out Accumulate. So I did. So I looked at all the algorithms. And here they are. The pre-C++17, there's 90 of them, I believe. Now, some of these we can just remove straight away. Swap and iter swap, they really aren't loops, so get rid of those. One of these in particular, Stefan would make an angry face at me if I implement it, so I got rid of random shuffle. and then of the remainder, some are sort of binary search style things, which aren't really amenable to linear traversals, and some are heap operations, which also involve jumping around inside your sequence. But of the remainder, there are 77 that remain. These are basically plain loops. And with a bit of jiggery-pokery and bending the rules, I was able to implement all of them in terms of Accumulate. How long did it take me? A few weeks, to maybe a month of evenings, something like that. Just on and off, you know, sort of thing. So one of the key things that unlocked it was, so of course Accumulate does work on iterators, but the one thing so we dereference the thing that we passed the binary operation here, and if we don't do that, not that I'm suggesting that, you know, the STL should be updated at all, but just reformulating Accumulate in terms of in this format allowed me to treat iterators as accumulatable values, and that's what allowed me to implement all the rest of the algorithms. So now I'm the first to admit that some of these things are a little abusive. Using exceptions for control flow is not something I usually like to do, but you know, for things like find, which have the early out, I did do that. Reverse, I was particularly pleased with. It involves accumulating a function, and as you step down the forward iterator, you wrap the previous function that you've accumulated in a new function, and then at the end you call the whole stack of functions, and it unwinds the sequence in reverse. So, the point of this really is to say that when you do kind of algorithmic perversions like this, interesting alternatives can arise. You know, I'm not suggesting that we should ever actually use those formulations of reverse or use exceptions for control flow. But you know, when you start looking at Accumulate, you realize that you can do other algorithms like find all, you know, a parallel find if. A parallel adjacent find might be possible. Min element that returns an optional value might be an interesting formulation. Or sort with forward iterators. In fact, there was I think P227 was a proposal that proposes weakening the iterator categories of some of the algorithms like sort, and I think, what do you remember the others, Marshall?
I don't. I remember the paper.
Okay.
And it's a really interesting paper. I mean, it's based on some stuff that Stefan and others have done.
But, right.
But I haven't actually implemented that, so I don't actually.
I see.
I don't have a real strong opinion.
Okay, so there's an interesting paper that proposes weakening the iterator categories, because right now sort requires a random access iterator, and you know we know algorithms that can work with forward iterators. So that would be an interesting thing, perhaps. So. Really the conclusion of this talk is that I would suggest to you that almost everything can be expressed as some form of accumulation. When I go hunting for raw loops in my code base, I found increasingly that I was, you know, as well as saying, oh, that's a find, that's a partition, that's a rotate, kind of the overarching thing would be, that's an accumulate. You can do that with accumulate. That could be an accumulate. Not that you should everywhere, that's for you to decide. But when you get used to seeing these monoidal patterns and things that can be accumulated, they end up everywhere. Here are some links which you can peruse at your leisure. This will be in the slides, of course. You want to take a picture? Go ahead.
It'll be in the slides.
Okay. So anytime you write an API, look to see if any of the types you're providing are monoidal or under any operations you provide. Because if you can identify that and document it, then you open the opportunity for your users of your API to get all this stuff for free. Look for opportunities where you're applying a function in a loop. If the output of the function is a monoid, it could be a place where you can use accumulate. Monoids are everywhere, of course. Consider folding over heterogeneous sequences and multidimensional structures using formulations like the ones I've shown. They can be useful too. And what the use they give you is effectively separating the traversal from the operation. You can go ahead and define multiple operations and treat them the same way in the traversal. And then unfolds are another way you can think about things, and you can combine them perhaps with folds to produce arbitrary transformations. And finally, algorithmic perversions, I highly recommend looking at the STL and trying to write your own algorithms, and Marshall has a talk about that later. And in the end, accumulation is not just for the boring stuff. So thanks very much.
So I have to say, your algorithms are a lot more interesting than the ones in my algorithms in my talk are pretty basic.
Okay, so Marshall's comment is that my algorithms are more interesting than his. I'm not sure that's fair, but... anyone have questions? Yes. Okay, so, right. You can't always use, so the comment, I guess the comment is, sometimes you try to use accumulate, but you can't because you don't have iterators. So the non-iterator accumulate or the accumulation over things other than iterators is pretty useful and worth generalizing, you think. Cool. Vincent, you had a question.
So you gave the example of Roman numerals, but are there any other examples for the unfolding? Do you see examples?
Other examples of unfolding. Unfold is a thing that happens in functional languages, and I went to a friend who's pretty au fait with that kind of thing, much more up to date than I am, and I asked him, at a functional meetup group, I said, it looks like unfold is very similar to fold. Where would you use one and where would you use another? And in typical fashion, he said, well, they're both implicit things you can do on a sequence. He gave an answer which wasn't terribly satisfying. I think it makes sense. Maybe it makes sense just by convention for thinking about the either reducing a data structure to what we might think of as normally a value or unfolding a seed. I mean, it's similar in some sense to generate or generate n when you're using a seed value, you're calling a generator function to fill in the sequence. I don't have a hard and fast rule to say you should use this unfold here and accumulate here, but they are quite similar. You'd call it factory?
Yeah,
so unfolding, parsing, making objects, in some way. Deserialization.
It's a good example of the unfolded. It's a deserialization where the file then deserializes the scene, this heterogeneous graph.
Right. In the back.
I guess it wouldn't be more performance of factoring a number is unfolded.
So factoring a number could be viewed as unfold in a highly unperformant manner, is the comment. Yeah, I have a feeling that when you factoring a number is a pretty well understood and attacked operation, and I doubt that Unfold would be. It's true. New approaches, and as I say, algorithmic perversions are a good thing. Yeah.
I think the example that the heterogeneous sequence is pretty awesome. And for example, could you represent something like composite function with it? Really much more powerful than just the homogeneous sequence. And if so, could we have something proposed in the language, because it really looks really powerful.
So the comment is that the folding heterogeneous things looks really powerful, similar to composing functions. Yes, function composition is a monoid. So you could do that. And well, yeah, maybe. I mean, STL2 is, coming perhaps. Write a paper.
the most powerful thing to convince people that something is really useful is to have something that's really useful.
Yes, that's true. If there's an implementation which you can show the committee is being used and solving a problem, that does a lot to get their attention.
I did searcher stuff for C++ 17. Having an implementation in Boost that I could point to that people were using was a
yes.
Useful.
Yes. The searching stuff that Marshall did for 17 is an example of that. Also, I would say the special math functions are an example of that. There was already, special math functions aren't something that I'm likely to use in my everyday, but there was already, there is a community that wants them. There was already a high quality implementation. And on the reverse side, the implementation thing is one of the reasons why concepts aren't yet in the standard, but still in the TS, because there's not enough implementation experience yet. Yeah. Right, so the observation is, yes, in Clojure, if you've watched Rich Hickey's talk on transducers and followed that stuff, you'll know that transducers are a similar thing where it's sort of teasing apart traversals from what you're doing to the data structure, and in similar fashion, everything can be implemented in terms of folds and transducers. This is very much, I'm cribbing everything from functional languages here, so... But hopefully, giving it a C++ spin and showing where it might be useful. Was there a question over here? Yes?
I was going to say also that Unfold, I think, could be reformulated to be a poll instead of a push, where it's sort of a factory for something that you can iterate over. And then you can use Unfold for things like the value you're unfolding is the state of MPEG.
Okay, so yeah, that would be interesting. So the idea is if you formulated Unfold in terms of a pull rather than a push, you could have, the example given was an MPEG decoder pulling frames off a queue. That would be an interesting formulation. All right, well, thank you very much.